You are listening to the Radical Inclusivity Podcast, brought to you by William Jewell College, Kansas City's critical thinking college. Now over to our co-hosts, Dr. Rodney Smith, Vice President of Access and Engagement at William Jewell College, and Al Ioni, Director of the Tucker Leadership Lab. Take it away, folks.
That being said, man, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself to us, and we'll jump right to it.
Sure. So I'm Jaron Raven. I'm the President and CEO of Swope Health. I'm a Texas boy, born and raised, but have been here in Kansas City almost 4 years now. Humble beginnings, but a real belief in mission-driven work and social justice work. And most folks, you find that, somebody just asked me the other day, well, how I ended up at this job. And you'll find that most folks have this kind of catalytic event that turns their life in a certain direction in terms of their passions. For me, I had a grandmother who contracted cancer, but what I saw was a health system that didn't work for everybody. And so that kind of led me to where I am now.
Wow. Interesting. So yeah, tell us a bit more about your background, like your you know, official training, your professional training, educational training, if you will, and how it relates to the work you do at Swope Health. I really love how you segued into how you got here as far as the work that you do regarding your grandmother.
Yeah, it's interesting. So my background, I think, is helpful for leaders today. And the reason I say that is because I came out of, when I worked for a health center, and this is 11 years ago, I was the guy at a table in a corner with a, covered up with a drape cloth and some pins that I'd hand out to people and say, hey, come here for healthcare, right? And I had my 30-second spiel. Now, that helped me understand how to engage communities in a really authentic way, because I didn't really want anything from them. I just wanted them to stop using the emergency room. That was my goal, to show them a better answer than using that type of episodic care, which it's not good for anybody. The taxpayers, their health in terms of continuity doesn't help with anybody. So that taught me how to engage these communities in an authentic way and recognize that you present yourself as a resource, then you would be better accepted. So I moved from that to then going into to law school. I thought that I would be the next great Thurgood Marshall and be some incredible civil rights lawyer. And I wasn't that smart. So what I ended up doing is going to law school and really found myself thinking about my passion for healthcare and healthcare access. And before I graduated, there was an organization out in Seattle, Washington, that needed somebody to do government relations work for them, to go basically lobby on behalf of community health centers in the state of Washington, in the Washington legislature. I had formerly been a staff member for a city council member in Houston. If you know any political staffers, they work really hard and don't make any money. And that's exactly what I did for a number of years, then law school. And then I went there to do government relations work. And then I started thinking, so wait a minute, do I have what it takes to run a health system, right? I think I know how to engage people. I think I know how to lead people. I understand policy, and that's a helpful skill set for any leader of any organization. And so I went from government relations to then begging someone to give me an opportunity to be a chief operations person in Jackson, Mississippi. And I did that for 4 years. And then I got a phone call about, there's a health center in Kansas City that has a CEO that's retiring. Would you be interested in the job? I'm 36 at the time. So I'm thinking this is some type of practical joke. And they were serious. And so 9 months later, went through that entire process of the interview and ended up here in September 2019. But to your question, Dr. Smith, the background that I think is most helpful for me in this job is communications, which I graduated from Howard with a communications degree, the legal field, that critical thinking of lawyering that can help you get through problems, the government relations work, and then certainly healthcare leadership, academia. I did a degree from that at Brown University. All those things cost a lot of money, but they've helped me figure out how to navigate and lead the best way.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing from you, Jaron, is just talking about how interconnected everything is. Like, healthcare doesn't operate in this vacuum where I get a degree in healthcare and I work just in healthcare, but it is in all facets of our life, whether we are immediately interacting with the healthcare system or not.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, I think to lead it, healthcare is so dynamic right now. So there was a quote I read, a fact I read maybe earlier this year. It said a best practice in healthcare takes 18 years to reach from ideation beginning state to the rest of the health delivery systems. 18 years, right? From one best, you know, an idea to go into a best practice that's worldly or wildly used, right? And so that just tells you that in order to keep up with the system, with the industry itself, you got to be well-rounded. You got to be well-rounded.
Wow. You said 18 years for an idea that's, you know, first sort of broached.
Yep.
Then it takes 18 years for it to come to fruition or to be widely used.
Be widely used, yeah. So from ideation to ideation to in the middle to this has been established as the best practice to now their best practice being identified and used by everyone else in healthcare, right? 18 years.
Wow. Yeah, I thought, well, higher education, I don't know the numbers, but I would imagine higher education is a very similar thing. It's it's a slow, methodical industry. But it does generate some, I think, great ideas for all of us to participate in. So not shifting gears, but sort of segueing into some things that you've said and relating it back to even the title of this podcast, where we call it Radical Inclusivity. And Radical Inclusivity is our approach here at William Jewell College to how we do our work around diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. Mm-hmm. It's you know how we've been thinking about it in the last couple of years on campus and having these conversations, you know. So what comes to mind and how can it relate to the work that you do in and around healthcare, this notion of being, you know, radically inclusive with regard to healthcare?
Yeah, no, right. So, we've had these discussions many times before. I mean, you know, healthcare is an interesting thing. I tell people it's the most personal service you'll ever receive in your life. It is. Most of your embarrassing moments and sometimes in your case, maybe your best moments might, you know, you'll face a healthcare provider. You also face a healthcare provider in your first, when you walk into life and when you come out oftentimes, right? The thought of making a place for everyone when you engage the health system should be the goal of any healthcare leader, for everyone, right? Because it matters. It actually drives health outcomes. We talk about the maternal, the facts around maternal Black health and the fact that Missouri in particular has some serious work to do. And the distinction in that data when they have a provider that looks like them, right? Now, there's only 3-4% of Black providers in the United States, and probably less than that are OBGYNs. And so you're looking at a small margin. But the goal is really to create a health system that responds to everybody that you can, you know, it's almost like it's these little kind of simple nuanced instances of life, right? You walk, let's say, you know, Rod, you're in Idaho somewhere, okay? And actually, I'll give you, this is a true story that's happened to me. I was in Seattle. I was in Olympia, Washington. 2 hours south of Seattle, and I walked out of my apartment, and a brother, Black guy, who I hadn't first one I'd seen in, you know, first Black person I'd seen in about 6 months. This cat walked up to me and gave me a hug and said, "Man, it's just good to see you." Still don't know his name. Never even got his name. but the point that I'm making is, like, you know, there should be a place of belonging for everybody. It's unfortunate, but it's true that in healthcare, a place for someone to belong can impact their health outcomes, right? So that's the way that I approach. That's the way we've approached that SWOPE for 53 years we've been in operations.
And I wonder if you could unpack that just a little bit more on examples of how belonging affects medical outcomes, just because I know, like, that can be a big idea to wrap your mind around?
Yeah, that's a deep question. You know, so part of it is just ensuring that we are humanizing people and showing up for them the way that we need them to show up for them, the way that, you know, that they need us to show up for them. When we have patients who are complaining of pain, it's not the provider's role, it's not the nurse's role, it's not my role to judge what they indicate as the level of pain, which happens quite often, particularly with African-American patients. It's our job to accept that at face value and respond to it as providers, right? We're in the business of healing people. And so, I mean, that's a slight example, but you know, you think about someone who walks into a healthcare facility, they're never there because they want to be there. They're there because something's wrong, right? And so now you're faced with dealing with attempting to heal yourself, make yourself better. There's already high stress levels. You're likely uncomfortable. You're likely having someone with you that is taking time away from their day to bring you to the facility, so on and so forth. It's all these things that are like a amalgamation of bad vibes, right? For lack of a term. Okay. So how do we address that as healthcare providers in a way that releases some of that? You know, there are many instances where we receive patients that are, their blood pressure is so high, there's no way they should even be here. They should be in the ER. No way they should be here, right? And part of that is the way that we think we want to respond to them in a way that calms them down, that lowers their blood pressure, that we're talking to them in a calm voice, that they are sure that they're going to be okay. The little things matter. Those little things matter. They really do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it makes me think about what you were saying in the beginning about how we don't need everybody to go to the ER, right? We need people to have these long-lasting relationships so they keep going back and getting their checkups and stuff. Like, I think about my husband, who, I'm just going to rat him out here. He hates going to the dentist and like will avoid it at all costs. Like, I have to like set up a reward system to go to the dentist. And for him though, like when we finally found a place that he liked, he was like, oh, I felt calm there. I felt cared for there. I felt like that was a place I could go back to. And so now, like, if something does happen with his tooth, right, he's not going to be in pain forever. He's not going to let the negative health outcomes of that bad tooth continue to affect him. He's going to get him taken care of sooner. Like, that relationship is the step in the door for folks to get that care that's going to improve their quality of life, not just their quantity.
Yeah, it matters. I mean, it's the little things. Healthcare doesn't, we don't do a very good job of borrowing from other industries that do things really well, right? And so most healthcare institutions, hospitals aren't really people friendly. They don't look people friendly. They don't interact. They're not built for the patient. They really aren't, right? And so one of the things that I have to give credit to Blue Cross Blue Shield, when they made Spirocare, I was talking to someone who kind of led that whole process, that new business for them. I said, Jerry, we wanted to build a clinic that felt like a living room, right? Mm-hmm. And I took that and I said, I'll do you one better. So we spent $3 million renovating our lobby to ensure that when our patients come in, this place feels like a Taj Mahal to them. We want them to feel comfortable, to feel like they're getting the best treatment. And the moment they walk in the door, and what's true about people generally is when they walk into a place that has a certain level of cleansiness, of open windows, of sunlight, of a place of dignity or respect, they conduct themselves that way also. Right. I mean, you change it. It's almost like when you go to a nice restaurant and you're underdressed, you feel a little uncomfortable, right? It's the same place in certain facilities. You want to make sure that you're on your best behavior and people want to treat you with respect and dignity. And it makes for a better experience for everybody.
Yeah. Wow. That's an interesting thought. And I think that you're right. There's research out there that supports this idea that people change their behaviors according to the environment. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna try to tie my question back to something you said earlier when you were walking out your door in Seattle and this brother comes up and hugs you, and you know, and you know, having never met you, never knowing you, for some reason it kind of for me, and you said you hadn't seen an African-American person in months or weeks prior to that. It for me, it makes, you know, as a social scientist, as a sociologist, it makes me think about community, neighborhoods. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, why would that be someone's experience to have gone, you know, 6 weeks or so without seeing a reflection of themselves? But it also leads me into, makes me think about, especially with regards to healthcare. I've heard several healthcare professionals, including yourself, in conversations about these idea, this terminology that may be familiar to some, but unfamiliar to others, social determinants of health.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And how what are they, first of all, and why do they matter? And what does one's environment or where they live have to do with social determinants of health?
Man, how long is this scheduled for?
As long as you need.
So that's a great question. Great. So social determinants and social drivers of health, it's really, to me, it's nothing that we didn't already know. But it is recognizing it, right? Which I think is a lot of what's happening right now with DEI. We'll get to that later.
Mm-hmm.
We're accepting the idea that having a multitude of voices around the room and in the room produce a better product, right? We should just accept that. We should also accept that if you have more liquor stores in your neighborhood than parks, if you have more check cashing places than green space, you might not end up being a healthy individual and a contributing member of society in a way that you could have been in terms of your health and longevity, right? So your social drivers are recognizing your access to education, your access to economic inclusion, prosperity. Can you get a job in certain communities, right? Your interaction with violence, your proximity to violence, right? Your access to green space and exercise. And then social context. Are you in an environment like the brother who hugged me, where you can see yourself, where you can feel loved and nurtured and cared about, right? Those things matter. They matter a lot. You know, some would say that it's 80% of who you are in terms of your health is the environment that you grow up in. I mean, there's a reason why, if you think about these cancer alleys across the country, these places in Black and Brown communities where all of a sudden these diseases that aren't prominent in African-Americans, aren't prominent in our Latino brothers and sisters, right? They're prominent in these places because they're surrounded by landfills and they have, you know, there's tire production places by them. There's all these manufacturing institutions that are impacting their healthcare. All those things matter, right? KCPS, we have a fantastic superintendent. I think she's going to be great. I'm praying that she has a long tenure the way that Dr. Padel did, because this idea that Dr. Padel was the longest serving superintendent at KCPS and he only served 6 years, as a community, we should be concerned about that, right? We should be concerned about that.
Yeah, that's a great point. That is a great point with regard to the ecosystem, if you will. Right.
That's it, perfect.
And how it contributes to our lives. And I think that sometimes we overlook the significance of that. And we just kind of take it for granted, especially those of us who don't necessarily have to worry about environment so much.
Sure. I mean, it's what's frustrating about it, it's a never ending cycle.
Yeah.
Hurt people, right? If you grow up in a community with trauma, you will never develop, you know, I shouldn't say never, it would be more challenging for you to develop the emotional and social skills to deal with challenges in your life in a way that's healthy,
mm-hmm. right?
I said this the other day, we had a panel on community violence. If you grow up in an environment where respect is currency and you can exchange that, and your way of getting respect is through violence, right? And that's the way to keep people from hurting you and keep you from hurting people you love, that's what you're going to do, right? That's what you're going to do. If you grow up in that environment, that's what you're going to do. And so these communities that have been neglected for 50 plus years now that have been challenged with resources and or have been given things to undermine their success, right? The likelihood of their success. We talk about, I don't want to go to the cocaine area, but we can discuss what they did to decimate those communities in the 80s and 90s, right? I don't know, and I hate to say this because I try to be an optimist. I am challenged with the idea of how we might catch up, how those communities can catch up. Because the one, in my opinion, the uncomfortable truth that people need to recognize is the only way to restore what was taken from them is to provide resources that they never had. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, generate resources new. You have to take resources from somewhere else. And that's an uncomfortable truth.
Yeah, man, that's a conversation that I've been having internally and externally, and a conversation that we've been, you know, thinking about and even talking about here at William Jules Campus in the form of the Racial Reconciliation Commission,
mm-hmm.
and talking about our history as an institution and our involvement with the institution of slavery,
mm-hmm.
and how then now one of the questions that we ask ourselves as a critical thinking college is the three questions that we ask ourselves. What is truth?
Mm. I like that's deep.
How do we know it's true? And then how then shall we live according to that truth?
Hmm.
Those are the three kind of critical thought questions that we ask ourselves. And your comments with regard to repairing and restoring, making people whole, you know, makes me think about another word that we've been hearing floating around in society that a lot of people have deemed a dirty word in some regards, this word of reparations.
I knew that was coming. Yeah, let me say this. Restorative justice is probably less controversial than reparations, although restorative justice is probably a little bit broader. But let me say this. I think people overcomplicate the idea of reparations. Countries, particularly the United States, we found ways to heal harmed people. We did it with the Japanese once we were in internment camps. I think we people overcomplicated. There's resources that there are things obviously that that African Americans and other oppressed people have been taken, that have been prohibited from, that we can easily restore, right? Yeah. You give first time college graduates that are African Americans, Latinx and others that are oppressed, zero college debt, zero college fees. It's one way to do it. If you ensure that their neighborhoods have adequate resources, that's another way to do it, right? There's ways to do this. It's very hard for me to believe that we have figured out a way to get to other planets, but we can't find a way to give money to oppressed people. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it comes back to that. I mean, this idea of fairness, right? And like, there's nobody loses if we put somebody on the moon, but if we give money to somebody and not somebody else, then clearly there's a loser. And like that mindset needs a recalibration.
Yeah.
If you're truly to envision a future with equity. And I just wonder, like, how do I want to ask this? Because I feel like healthcare has such a stringent box around it of what it's allowed to look like here in the US. So like, how do you envision that forward when you run into walls that are as sturdy as the idea of things have to be fair and things have to be equal? Does that make sense?
It does. Here's what I love about where healthcare is right now, and I think that might be helpful. And we just talked about it with Dr. Smith's question about the social determinants. it gives healthcare leaders a lane to go try to impact everything. Mm-hmm. Right now, you're telling me that all these things that are outside the walls of the health center impact healthcare, then that gives me some type of leeway to go impact those things. Mm-hmm. Now, then healthcare institutions can build housing. Now we can build parks. Now we can, we can partner with the local minor league baseball team to engage communities that have not normally been engaged in the sport of baseball and or healthcare. Right. There's all these different things that we can do now with broader lanes. I am troubled, and I hope I'm asking your question. I am troubled by what we're hearing out of the state legislature in terms of oppressing or penalizing organizations that are doing really good DEI work. Right. It's the contradiction is interesting to me. You have some folks in the state house saying that they care about our maternal health, the ranking Missouri has in infant mortality and mother mortality in the country, while at the same time punishing health systems for trying to hire Black OBGYNs. Doesn't make sense. Because either you don't care about the mother and child, as you're saying, it just doesn't make sense. But it's ingenuine at best, right? It's disingenuous at best. I'm hoping I'm answering your question. But I think we have a broader stage to do better work. That's hopeful. I am not surprised. I'll say this: I'm not surprised by the response that we're getting right now. I think most of us, particularly people of color, I think most of us knew that any large social progress we make always comes with some type of response and reaction, right? I had to remind my leadership team the other day that most of the Confederate statues in this country weren't built after the Civil War, but they were built after the Civil Rights Act. There's a reason for that, right? There's always this response to these things. And so I'm unfortunate to have seen it, and hopefully one day we won't see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's so many questions, man. I know we only have a certain amount of time with you. There's so many questions I want to ask you, because, you know, Al's question, you know, made me think of, you know, the future of healthcare. But also, if you think about the future of healthcare, you have to think about the past of healthcare. You also think about how healthcare is perhaps showing up in other countries in relationship to America. I have, again, we perhaps had these conversations in private.
Yeah.
I have my strong feelings and thoughts about how healthcare is seen, how much it costs, all those kinds of things. So where do we go, man? What is the future of healthcare in America? How can we fix this? How can, you know, with the, you know, our conversation around diversity, equity,
sure,
and inclusion. So how can we be more equitable with regard to how people receive healthcare?
Oh, man. So let me say I want to start with something that's ambitious, and then I'll go to what's a little bit more practical. The whole system would need to change, right? For things to be equitable. I mean, the other day we had Schwab Health was in the New York Times, first time in the history of the organization. On the cover of the New York Times, a gentleman came down here to do a story around Medicaid unwinding. What that means is those that are on Medicaid during the pandemic, the states were prohibited from kicking anybody off Medicaid. That is no longer the case. April 1st, that deadline stopped. And so now states like South Carolina, Missouri, so on and so forth, states that were not always receptive to the idea of Medicaid expansion can kick those off if they don't have their address right, little minor administrative technical things, right? And it was estimated 15 million people are likely going to lose healthcare. And it was interesting to me, one of the reporters said, this is an idea that's only possible in America. In Sweden, if you mentioned 15 million Swedes getting kicked off healthcare, they would say, what? What are you? It's like, it's not even conceivable. It's not even conceivable, right? It's just not a thing. And so we need to accept the idea of healthcare as a human, as a fundamental human right.
That's right.
It shouldn't matter where you're in Belton, Missouri, or Kansas City, Missouri, or Des Moines, Iowa, or some other part. It shouldn't matter. If you're a human being, you should be born with the right of having access to quality healthcare. The one thing I do appreciate about where we are, though, is that there's more devices, there are more technology that are coming out, becoming more obsessed with, that puts healthcare in people's hands. So some of the things that we talk about in terms of not feeling like you belong in certain spaces might be minimized because you can really control most of it yourself, right? You can go engage with an African provider of your choice, for that matter, from home, right? And so the access might be a bit better. Now, there's the digital divide has to get better for some of that, those things to happen. But I do appreciate the fact that we're really in a patient empowerment moment where, and for some communities, patients can really take control of their outcomes by engaging providers that they want and not just engage providers because they're down the street.
I love your answer so much. And I just have to express my heartbreak that when you introduced your answer, you were like, I'll start with the like bigger, more audacious one and move to the practical, and the idea of re-envisioning our healthcare system just doesn't even seem on the practical list at some point.
There's a really good book called The History of Medicaid and Medicare. And the reason why I can say that with some sense of being informed is because that 50-year book talks about all the attempts that we did mm-hmm. to make a universal healthcare system, starting back to the 30s.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, I would say Obama got the closest.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and he's also somebody who was impacted by, you know, the care that he saw someone he loved give or was given in the healthcare system, decided he needed to do something to change it. So the history of it is tough. And but we are incrementally getting there. I just hope it's not going to take another generation to get where we need to get.
Yeah. Yeah, mountains. And I agree with you. I think Obama has gotten the closest with the Affordable Care Act. And I think the revolutionary work that took place as a result, and still in some regards, still happening in providing healthcare for people, you know, across and throughout the country.
I'm sorry.
You know, go ahead.
I was going to say, as much as I'm complaining, and I am complaining a bit, I will say that this is the most insured that the United States has ever been. Between the federal marketplace, Medicaid expansion, Medicare for adults, and Medicaid for kids, for, you know, CHIP specifically, this is the most insured our population has ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I haven't heard your commentary as complaining. You know, I heard it as concern for our society, for our country, for our people. And so, yeah, that's how I've interpreted it sounds like you're concerned for the healthcare people. That's why you do the work that you do.
Yeah.
Because, again, health and healthcare should be a human right that we all have access to, whether we can afford it or not. and so that's been one of the pet peeves for me. And from my vantage point, I've been fortunate to have had, you know, family members who are doing quite well, you know, health-wise. You know, my mom and dad are both in their early 80s and living pretty active lives and pretty healthy lives. And so I hadn't had a chance to the opportunity just yet to be really confronted with the ebbs and flows of the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
Though I just lost a really important aunt of mine who I think was subjected to some poor healthcare, inappropriate healthcare, and we ultimately lost her, you know? So I just don't want that for the masses, you know, of
yeah.
people.
Yeah,
because to your point, I love the way you framed it earlier in the conversation. It's like, in order for you to get here, you're going to have to deal with a medical professional as far as your birth. And mm-hmm. in your death, you're going to be dealing with a medical professional. So I think that fact alone we need to do a better job of including more people and having better access to the kind of healthcare that they need. So well, any closing remarks, man, with regard to everything and all that we talked about? Yeah.
So two things, and I'll try to be brief. One of the things that you just mentioned, rather, that's really been on my mind lately is there was this kind of heightened level of respect for healthcare workers during COVID.
Yeah. And
I want to make sure that that doesn't go away, right? We literally trust these people with our lives and the lives of people we care about. And we need to build a system in which rest and belonging and wait for them not to burn out. And the biggest thing for me is for them not to lose a lack of empathy. That's the most dangerous thing they can do as a healthcare provider, right?
Mm-hmm.
We see it. I see prosecutors. I see defense attorneys. You see the same. You engage someone's worst day of their life every day for several years. At some point, you got to start to care a little less. You're a little burned out by it, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we prevent that for healthcare workers? We need to really elevate their status in society as healers and give them the resources that they need. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think one of the questions that we maybe didn't get to was around where do people get DE&I wrong?
Mm.
And I thought about that a little bit. It's a great question, by the way. When I thought about that a bit, and I want to share this with you, that recognizing that things are spectrums, right? And you just got to start somewhere and hopefully you end at a much better place. I hope we can get to a point where DEI isn't a thing in an organization. It's not in a place, right? Whereby, and it's needed in some organizations. It kind of depends on where you are in that journey. And I appreciate that. But I hope we can get to a moment where, because we accept that diverse answers, diverse lived experiences build a better product, that's just the understood culture within organizations. And it's going to take some time, because it took some time for SWOP to get there.
Yeah. You know, I really appreciate you saying that, man, especially as, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion leader, a change management, you know, manager, if you will, around the idea of equity. I appreciate hearing you say that. Because I think I believe a very similar thing, and often, you know, I have a very similar wish and hope, in that I want people to see this work that we're embarking upon as not separate and apart from, but a part of, mm-hmm. just like we see the finances of an organization. You understand that your organization can't live without proper and healthy finances. Or, you know, budgets and all those kinds of things. So we have to have this similar respect for the diversity that humanity already is. You know, I often, you know, think about how negligent we have been with regard to honoring the diversity that already exists in humanity. I mean, because I argue that diversity and humanity are synonyms. You know, and I think we need to do a better job. And so your comments, you know, made me really, you know, think about that aspect. And I really, you're right. I think with regard back to your comments with regard to healthcare professionals and how they were elevated into elevated space and place at the height of the pandemic, and which they should have had that elevated place and space all along because of the mere fact that they, you know, they save lives. They are healers. I love the fact that you call them healers on a daily basis. I just went to see my healthcare provider at Spirocare, by the way, a few days ago. You know, but no, to your point, and when you said that, it just made me think of when I walk into that space, it does indeed feel like a living room. Yeah. So I think that they really hit the mark with regard to that, making people feel comfortable in that place and space.
Do you remember, real quick, and I'll probably let you go, do you remember when Obama was giving a speech several years ago about education? I forgot where it was, but he referenced that I think it's Japan, refers to their teachers as nation builders.
I do remember that.
And so you think about, you juxtapose that with the way that we consider teachers here and the way that we consider healthcare providers here, right? But them using that expression should indicate where they place them in the importance of a thriving society, right? The need for them. And so that's a big difference between that and the way we kind of review healthcare providers here, healthcare workers here, and generally healthcare professionals here. And it shouldn't only be when there's a pandemic, right? When there's a novel issue that we're all trying to make sure that we survive from. So,
right. Yeah. That's a wonderful thought to close on. I'm sorry, Al.
No, I was just going to say, like, even on a daily, right? Like, they shouldn't just be healers when, like, my back's against the wall. Like, they should be healers when I'm like, hey, I've got this like weird crink in my neck and I need help, right? Like, it's not just a like line of fire moment that we care about them.
Yeah. So, yeah, to segue, you know, to sort of build upon Obama's comments of nation builders, I think that's what you said.
Yep.
So we can call healthcare providers world healers.
That's true.
Send it all the way up to the president.
Yeah, right. I mean, they are. I mean, if we really sit and think about the work that they do to keep us all healthy,
it takes a special person. It really does.
I can't do it.
No, I know I can't do it. I'm mad. And they know I can't do that job, you know. I don't know if they can do mine either. But the point, I'm making is that it takes to go in every day and care about a stranger as if they're family.
That's right.
And think about whether or not you can help them reach a better place in their healthcare journey. Man, that's special. That is a gift, man.
It really is.
Gift.
Yes, it is. You know, I know we just we were trying to close this conversation.
I know. I mean, I'll let y'all go.
No, but it made me think of an experience I had this morning. And we our nursing department had I sit on the advisory board for our nursing department here on campus, and they had an annual meeting this morning. We had breakfast, and I was sitting around a table full of healthcare providers, nurses, and various organizations around the community who had some connection to the nursing program here on campus. And man, I walked away feeling like when I need medical care and, you know, in a hospital, I would want one of the young people that I was talking to this morning to be in,
that's right,
to be in charge of taking care of me, because they just understood at a level that, and they were saying things that I never considered with regard to providing care for another human being, to your point, that they go into a room and they treat strangers like family every single day. To your point earlier about some of the most embarrassing moments in our lives, or perhaps in healthcare, personal, you know? And these people are there to help us with those situations. So we have to provide more respect to these, show more respect to these individuals who do this kind of work. So Jared, man, thank you for agreeing to join us on our podcast here at William Jewell. We don't take it lightly that you've, you know, taken an opportunity to spend, you know, a few minutes with us, man, to share your, not just your wisdom, but your passion and your heart. And I really heard that, and I'm sure our listeners will too.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. You guys are doing good work over there. I'm glad this podcast exists. It's a good sign. Things are going in the right direction. William Jewell, and that both of you guys are there. So I appreciate it. It's an honor to have the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. You have a good weekend.
All right. You too.
You have been listening to the Radical Inclusivity Podcast, brought to you by William Jewell College. Visit us online at www.jewell.edu. That's Jewell with two L's, .edu. William Jewell College, Kansas City's Critical Thinking College.